This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I appreciate you tuning in. I'm Joel Hilliker. Russian President Vladimir Putin is ramping up his offensive in Ukraine, which is getting a lot of press and global attention. Something that's getting less attention is how he is also ramping up his offensive back in Russia. That is, his offensive against anyone who would oppose him. This nation has such a brutal history of repression, even back to the days of the Tsars, but especially in the days of Soviet rule under Joseph Stalin. It seems Putin is reviving that authoritarian legacy. We'll have a conversation with Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about this. Then over to Europe, which has been responding to the war in Ukraine by boosting its military. Germany just announced it will immediately spend $100 billion on defense. Now we have a good idea of what a pretty sizable chunk of that $100 billion will go to. That is American stealth jets that are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about this and related stories about Europe using the Ukraine war as a prod to increase its nuclear power. For our third segment, we will go to Israel. Last Friday, we spoke about the Israeli president visiting Turkey, which is not exactly known as a friendly nation under Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Aside from the geopolitical and prophetic ramifications of warming relations between Israel and Turkey, there's an interesting archaeological angle to this. Josh Taylor mentioned it briefly last Friday, but it's the possibility that an important artifact currently in Turkey will be returned to Israel, the Siloam inscription. We're going to hear a report from the Trumpet's Jerusalem correspondent, Chris Eames, about the significance of this inscription. And I'll conclude today's show with a last word with a request of you, our listeners, to remember the message from the Trumpet in the time ahead. Let's talk now about Vladimir Putin and his crackdown on dissent among his countrymen. To talk about this, we have Jeremiah Jacques. Hello.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
It's always good to have you in. I want to start by talking about some statements that our editor-in-chief has made. He's drawn these comparisons between Vladimir Putin and Stalin. Can you just bring our listeners up to speed on some of the things that he has said, comparing these two men and how long he's been talking about this?
Sure, yes. In Mr. Fleury's 2017 booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, he makes this this comparison in some really stark terms. I'll just read a quote from that. It says, "Putin has a long pattern of diabolical evil on the level of Joseph Stalin. An abundance of fruits prove that. The Bible states, by their fruits you shall know them." And then a little further down, Mr. Fleury writes, "President Putin has military might and the will to use it. America has the power but lacks the will to use it. That is why we grovel before this evil empire, as President Ronald Reagan once called it. No leader in Russia has equaled Putin's diabolical evil since Joseph Stalin." So, you know, just a very clear comparison there of Putin to Stalin in 2017. But that was not the first time Mr. Fleury made this comparison. Back in 2008, he wrote an article in The Trumpet called The Armies of Armageddon. And in that one, he talked about a secret pact that Stalin had made with Adolf Hitler just before World War II broke out, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And Mr. Fleury said he believed that Putin and modern German leaders had already agreed to kind of a modern version of that old pact. And then there's actually a statement from an article Mr. Fleury wrote all the way back in 2004 along these same lines. So in 2004, very few people in the West were viewing Putin as much of a danger, you know, to the global peace or as any kind of dictator in the making. But that year, Mr. Fleury wrote about an election that Putin had interfered with. He'd rigged it to ensure that he would win it. And Mr. Fleury said that what was even more problematic than the rigging of the election was what Putin would go on to do with the victory that he had won and extended. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "The whole world should be alarmed. Mr. Putin was shaped and molded by the infamous KGB, Russia's ruthless, murderous secret service arm of the government made famous by Joseph Stalin." End quote. So, you know, Mr. Fleury there is connecting the dots between Stalin's tyranny, the brutal KGB that the Stalin system used to murder tens of millions of people, and the fact that Putin was a product of that system. You know, Putin spent 16 years as a KGB agent, partly living in East Germany. So he was really shaped by that system, and you can see that now in Putin's increasingly Stalin-esque leadership.
If you think back to what he was doing at the time, you kind of mentioned this, that there weren't a lot of people talking about Vladimir Putin in those terms at that time. What was the evidence that he was basing those statements on?
Yeah, well, Mr. Fleury did say there in the quote that I read that there is an abundance of fruits proving that Putin is becoming more like Stalin. In that 2017 booklet, he mentioned the way Putin pressured Ukraine's former president to scrap some agreements with Europe so that Ukraine could instead move deeper into Russia's orbit. Mr. Fleury also talked about Putin's war on the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. That's when he asserted power over about a fifth of Georgia's territory. And Mr. Fleury said that those kinds of moves showed that Putin was dead set on rebuilding the old Soviet Union. He also pointed to Putin's weaponization of natural gas, the way he shut it off to Ukraine and to other countries in order to pressure them into kind of doing Moscow's bidding. Mr. Fleury also wrote about the way Putin had poisoned some of his political opponents and had at least 130 Russian journalists murdered just for writing things that he found, you know, unflattering, I guess. And Mr. Fleury wrote about how Putin brought Russian businesses under government control. That's very reminiscent of Stalin's, you know, collectivization of farms and other Russian industry. Mr. Fleury also called a lot of attention to Putin's crackdown on the Russian press. You know, he dissolved Russia's primary news agency, replacing it with basically a PR tool to just promote Russia's image abroad. So there's no shortage of evidence that Mr. Fleury pointed to substantiate his comparison between Putin and Stalin. And really, it's only gotten worse since then. Mm-hmm. You know, it was in 2020 that Putin trampled all over Russia's constitution. He rewrote it to ensure that he can stay in power, definitely for 12 more years. And actually, now that it's done, it would be nothing at all for Putin to make another little amendment and stay there for as long as he lives. And then there's a new law that was just passed this month. And with that one, Putin authorized up to 15 years of incarceration for anyone who protests the current war on Ukraine.
Wow.
Even just calling it a war or an invasion, that's enough to fall foul of this new law.
15 years in prison for saying that Russia is at war.
Right. Yeah. You have to say it's a special military operation and a liberation.
Mm.
It's not a war. It's not an invasion. If you say it is, you could be looking at 15 years.
That's amazing. So, you know, I suppose what we're talking about is a question of degree. Like he's been doing these types of things quite regularly for some time, but now we're really seeing an intensification of this. And I guess the question, and maybe you can give us some more examples of the reports that are coming out showing how the level of repression is actually increasing. But I'm also interested in just how what characterized Stalin's rule maybe in the earlier years of his reign, and how did that develop over time? And are we basically seeing an escalation that would be kind of on the scale of or following a similar pattern to what we saw in Russia, say, in the earlier years of Stalin's reign?
Yeah, well, you know, Joseph Stalin, of course, it was a reign by terror with a grip of steel. He actually wasn't born with the name Stalin, but he gave that to himself. It translates to something like man of steel. And that's really how he ruled, with just ruthless totalitarianism, mercilessly eliminating anyone who might oppose him. He greatly expanded the powers of the secret police. He set up a system that encouraged Soviet citizens to spy on each other, had millions of people, maybe as many as 40 million people, killed or sent to the infamous Gulag system of forced labor camps. He famously instituted the Great Purge. That was a series of campaigns used to rid the Communist Party and the military and other aspects of Soviet society from anyone who might even potentially be a threat. And then, of course, he built a cult of personality around himself. You know, cities were named after him. His image was ubiquitous on all kinds of art. He had history books rewritten to elevate his role. He even added his name into the Soviet national anthem. And he had, you know, just near total control of the Soviet media. So no one could print or broadcast anything that didn't perpetuate this cult of personality. And it did happen over time. I think with Stalin, it happened more quickly than the progression that we've seen with Putin. But it was, you know, Stalin wasn't just right out of the gates doing all of this. It took a few years for the Great Purge to begin and for, you know, the murders to go from thousands into millions. And I think if you look at Putin, you could see his imprisonment of political foes and this new law criminalizing even the most innocuous protests. And you can see the cult of personality that he's cultivating.
Right.
You know, when you look at all of that, you see that Putin is heading down the same path as Stalin, and he's actually quite a ways down that path now.
Any other, I guess, egregious examples of the repression that we're seeing now?
One example I think we could look to is the way Putin shipped his main political opponent, Alexei Navalny, off to a prison camp for 3 years. That was after a sham trial found Navalny guilty of, I think it was sedition or some such charge. In reality, Navalny was just speaking out against Putin's corruption. But that kind of thing is straight out of Stalin's playbook. And I think there's a chance that Navalny's sentence could go far beyond 3 years. There's already talk of, you know, adding more charges to his term. So who knows? We may have seen the last of Navalny. Another very clear sign of Putin's, you know, trajectory down that direction came just over the last couple of days. Many Western multinationals have been suspending operations in Russia, in most cases just to protest this unconscionable war that Putin is waging on an entirely undeserving sovereign nation of 44 million people. We've seen Visa, MasterCard, American Express, you know, FedEx, UPS, Boeing, Airbus, PepsiCo, Starbucks, Apple, the big four accounting firms. The list goes on and on. Many of these companies had built their businesses in Russia over several decades, and now they're just untangling all their ties. Even major oil companies, Shell, BP, and Exxon, these companies are routinely accused of being only focused on the bottom line, even at the expense of moral considerations. But here they're proving to have a conscience, I think. They see that there's no nuance in this situation. So they've exited joint ventures with Russian companies, and they've otherwise severed ties, even though it's costing them tens of billions of dollars. So it's just a stinging rebuke to Russia. But Putin answered this just over the last 24 hours with a time-honored technique from the Soviet playbook. He drew up plans on Thursday to seize the assets of companies that are joining in this exodus from Russia. And so he's planning to nationalize them. The fine print says any company that is at least 25% foreign owned could find its assets seized and nationalized by the Kremlin. And then on March 14th, Putin followed that announcement up by passing a law that will make it possible for Russia to nationalize more than 500 airplanes that various Western leasing companies have demanded that Russia return to them. So these planes are owned by various Western firms. They're worth more than $10 billion. But now Putin's basically saying, these are ours now. And what are you going to do about it? So that's how doing business with Russia often ends. It ends in theft. But this is on a scale that's really hard to recall a comparable precedent for, at least in its size.
Well, forgive me if I'm a bit more cynical about the motivations of those multinational companies in getting out of Russia. I imagine that I guess with the way that the common wisdom in the West is going, that it's basically everything associated with Russia kind of marks you as a puts a black mark on your name. They're probably seeking their own interests as much as anything else. But Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, famous Russian survivor of the Gulag system, he talked about the fact that Germany went through the Nuremberg trials. Germany, after World War II, they arrested thousands of Nazis. But in Russia, I think he said that they only arrested something like 11 people for the atrocities that were committed in the Stalinist era. And he talked about how Russia, his home country, never atoned for its sins in World War II. It just swept them under the rug. I have heard, I believe it's credible, that that Putin has actually required the Gulag Archipelago, his famous volume about the gulags, be required reading for high schoolers in Russia. I just wonder what you make of that, and you know, what we're seeing right now, as you're talking about him going down essentially the same road that Stalin did. It seems like he's kind of dispensing with the pretext or the pretense, I guess, of being a more a conciliatory leader than his predecessor.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Solzhenitsyn has written very powerfully about the sheer evil of the Soviet system, and it is clear that the Soviet leaders never really acknowledged any real guilt on their part after the war. Solzhenitsyn made some very insightful comments also about how the atheistic elements of the Soviet system meant that leaders like Stalin saw themselves as the highest power in the universe. You know, and of course, that's a terribly dangerous view for any person to have. You can see why Stalin felt justified in murdering tens of millions if he thought that he had no one to answer to. And if he thought that he was a brilliant man doing what it took, do whatever it takes to build a utopia. And now Putin, it's harder to get a read on his religion. His mother was a devout member of the Russian Orthodox Church, but his father was an atheist. He often works closely with the church, but I think that's mainly just as a political tool to boost his power. So it's hard to say, but if you look at his behavior, it doesn't look like Putin fears any higher power,
right?
You know, and I think that makes him tremendously dangerous. As for requiring the Gulag Archipelago in high schools, I don't know. I just tend to think that life is not a fairy tale where the evil people are 100% evil and the good are 100% good. Like, I do think that he looks back on elements of the Soviet system and recognizes the brutality in it, and he wants his country to avoid some aspects of that. But then at the same time, the human mind is perfectly capable of rationalizing him saying, well, I'm not going down that path. I'm doing it differently. Mm-hmm. Even when the rest of us may look back and say, no, you're going down the same path. And in his mind, he's avoiding Stalin's mistakes and repeating his successes.
We haven't left a great deal of time to talk about the prophecies, but does prophecy indicate how far down this road Russia will actually go?
I think so, yes. If you look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, these are passages that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has said are about Vladimir Putin specifically and the massive multinational Asian army that he'll lead in the near future. And these passages show that this military behemoth will be almost more powerful than you can imagine. Related passages in the books of Revelation and Joel especially, it all shows that this force will have 200 million soldiers, and it will destroy a third of all men. So when you connect these dots, we should definitely expect Putin's might to keep on growing and for him to soon be commanding just a stunning amount of firepower. And those passages, I think, should also rein in any optimism about Russia's progress in this war on Ukraine. Many Westerners are saying, you know, Putin gravely miscalculated. This is exposing the myth of his military might. This is going to destroy him and end his reign. But this war is still in the early days, possibly. And that kind of optimism is premature at best. Also, on the topic of prophecy, I think it's very interesting that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, this Jewish president, he recently called Putin a beast. So it's not a term that you often hear applied to this type of ruler, but the Bible actually uses that same word to describe the type of leaders who are growing more and more powerful. Mr. Fleury wrote about this in a July 2014 article. He said, there's a reason God uses this terminology. Every leader of these Gentile kingdoms was under the sway of an evil spiritual influence and came to have the mind of a wild, fierce beast. When such men attain power, they become cunning, ferocious beasts. Throughout history, they have routinely thought like wild animals, wanting to conquer, pillage, burn, and destroy. God calls these leaders beasts for a reason, and we haven't even seen the worst of these beasts. So I think it's interesting that Zelensky called, you know, called Putin a beast, and Putin's behavior certainly shows that the term is merited. And that's something that Mr. Fleury has said is also of great prophetic significance.
What was that article you said, 2014?
Yes, it's called What Are the Times of the Gentiles, July 2014.
Well, we will link to that in the show notes for the program. Jeremiah also mentioned the Prophesied Prince of Russia booklet by Gerald Fleury and his article, The Armies of Armageddon. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Vladimir Putin's authoritarian crackdown on dissent within Russia and his moves toward really resurrecting some of the worst of the legacy of Joseph Stalin. Jeremiah is actually working on an article about this subject, and you can watch for that on thetrumpet.com in the time ahead. Thanks so much for your time, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
As Russia invades Ukraine, Europe is boosting its military might. Germany made the particularly stunning announcement that it would immediately spend $100 billion on defense, actually more than that, 100 billion euros, and raise its annual spending to 2% of GDP. To talk about where a good chunk of that $100 billion will go, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Helika.
AP is reporting that Germany is going to buy American stealth jets that can deliver nuclear bombs. Tell us about this.
Yes, there are some dramatic developments, and those debates have been going on for quite a few years. Germany was debating to buy those F-35s, but they are quite expensive, and Germany hasn't had a budget for them, so the debate was dragging on. But as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, the debate moved on, and they agreed now to buy around 35 US-made fighter jets. And by the way, they are the most advanced fighter jets in the world, and that's why it's believed that the United States has military superiority in any battle, at least in the air. But Germany is part of NATO, so that's also significant, and they can just buy those military jets, and the United States doesn't have any concern about it. However, Germany wants to buy them specifically to carry its nuclear weapons. That's the United States stationed nuclear weapons in Germany that Germany is allowed to use in a wartime with agreement of the NATO leadership, the agreement of the United States. And Germany has been practicing to use those nuclear weapons for years, but so far they only had their own fighter jets, tornado fighter jets. They're getting old, they can still use them, but the upgraded nuclear weapons will require an upgraded fighter jet, and the F-35s will be able to be used in that sense.
Germany is not considered a nuclear power, but those nuclear weapons are stationed right there in that country. And to longtime trumpet readers, knowing that Germany has these nukes and now is acquiring a very potent delivery system for them is quite amazing. Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been warning for decades about those nukes that are stored in Germany, American nukes stored there, and now Germany will have American jets to deliver those weapons. And as he has brought out, prophecy says that they're actually going to use those against the United States. Just looking at this pragmatically speaking, practically speaking, what's to stop Germany from using those nukes?
Practically speaking, something that can stop Germany from using the nukes are a few American soldiers that armed a code to those nukes. However, there have been quite a few glitches, there have been mistakes happened where those codes became visible, and quite a few analysts questioned the security of those nuclear weapons. However, US administrations beforehand warned that Germany could use those nukes and said it should be made physically impossible for Germany to use those nukes. However, there are lots of indications that those nukes aren't really in safe hand in Germany.
So for this this story to come out about them actually procuring these American jets, it's quite a dramatic story. It's actually not the only story about Europe focusing on nuclear deterrence after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Tell us about the discussion over German-French cooperation.
Yes, that's right. So after Russia invaded Ukraine, everyone thought, okay, Ukraine doesn't have any nuclear weapons. They gave them up for a piece of paper. We have to make sure that this doesn't happen to us. And another debate that was going on for a long time is, actually since after World War II, was that France should share its nuclear weapons with Germany. In the beginning, this was denied after World War II, and that's why Germany got permission to use NATO's nuclear weapons. But recent French administrations have offered for Germany to use, to share its nuclear umbrella and to basically expand that nuclear umbrella that France has over all of Europe. That Germany doesn't only have access to NATO's nuclear weapons, but to France's nuclear weapons. The difference would be they wouldn't need permission from NATO necessarily to use those nuclear weapons. And European People's Party leader in the European Parliament, Manfred Weber, he actually wrote an article saying now is the time. Now is the time that we should respond to France and really expand that nuclear umbrella over Europe, giving us access to France's nuclear weapons.
So if France has been a nuclear power for some time, the idea of Germany becoming a nuclear power, as you said, it's been quite verboten since World War II. It's pretty amazing that this taboo is being cast aside now. But looking at Germany's history in recent decades, how long would you say Germany's been looking for nuclear capability? What's some of the history?
Well, right at World War II, they were looking at getting the nuclear bomb, but there were a few incidences that prevented them from getting the nuclear bomb before, because the United States got them first in the end, and hence the World War ended differently than Germany hoped for. But right after, it's quite remarkable, right after World War II ended, they were looking again at getting nuclear weapons. Especially the second German defense minister, Franz Josef Strauß, he wanted to make sure that Germany has nuclear weapons. And the excuse again back then was Russia's advances in Eastern Europe. They said we need nuclear deterrence because Russia already gets the nuclear weapons and they could use them against us. So they said we need our own nuclear weapons. Of course, the idea was quite crazy. Just after Germany was defeated in World War II, you just can't arm them with nuclear weapons. And France was a bit uneasy at the time, and they denied that. And the German defense minister, he was upset, and he said the nuclear sharing agreement with NATO was kind of a joke. He felt like a little child who gets to play with the toy while America and France have the real thing. But he actually had plans to use those nuclear weapons without the United States' permission. And that's why the US administration in 1960 said, well, we have to make sure that Germany can't use those nuclear weapons. And another thing that Franz Josef Strauß really pushed then, and many people don't even talk about that, but he pushed for nuclear energy, so enriching uranium to produce energy instead of nuclear weapons. So today, Germany has one of the most advanced uranium enrichment facilities to enrich uranium for nuclear energy, but they could also use those to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons if they wanted to. And of course, those facilities are supposed to be closely observed, that something like that can't happen. But again, we know that the United States is supposed to watch the nuclear weapons in Germany or the facilities to produce enriched uranium to that level. But the United States simply trusts Germany so much that those measures Considering the United States' global budget for its military spending, those measures, after decades of observing Germany, they became quite casual about that. So that's another sign that things could go bad very soon.
I mentioned Gerald Flory talking about this for quite some time, that he has mentioned those American nuclear weapons that are stationed there. And he actually he was quoting Herbert W. Armstrong, who was talking about this decades ago, the fact that the United States was positioning nuclear weapons in a NATO ally, Germany, that it had defeated in World War II, and that those bombs were actually going to be used against the United States. That was a view that was informed by biblical prophecy. There are some really strong prophecies that Herbert W. Armstrong highlighted for decades and telling readers and listeners to watch Germany, watch Germany. Now, what we're seeing today, and Gerald Flory has been drawing attention to those same prophecies for decades now, what we're seeing today really is a dramatic fulfillment of exactly what we would expect based on biblical prophecy. Maybe you could just talk us through some of those prophecies that informed what Herbert W. Armstrong was warning about and what Gerald Flory has been reiterating.
Sure. So, of course, history gives us a warning that you shouldn't arm your historic enemy, especially with nuclear weapons. But there are also very specific, detailed Bible prophecies that show what's happening in Germany right now is more than alarming. We're seeing nuclear weapons stationed in Germany, and the Bible reveals that there will be cities laid waste without inhabitants. You can read it in Isaiah 6:11, and I quote that verse. Then said I, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and the houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. So here the prophet Isaiah asks, how long will you allow the suffering in this world? And God answers and shows how this world, the chaos in this world, will end. And he specifically says that cities will be wasted. Now, if you look up in the Bible commentaries, this talks about total destruction of cities. The buildings will be destroyed in that case. And that speaks of our day, of course. Nowhere in history have we seen something close to that. And Christ confirms that in Matthew 24, when he said that if God wouldn't intervene, no flesh should be saved alive. You can read that in the Moffat translation. That also shows that we are coming to a point where it is so bad that almost no flesh would be saved alive. No human being would stand alive in the end if God wouldn't intervene. No conventional warfare didn't really have that means before, but that speaks of nuclear weapons. Now, how can we know that Germany, the all-time enemy of the Israelitish nations, primarily the United States and Great Britain, would do such a thing? We see that there are bombs in Germany, but people believe that Germany is a friend and ally against Russia, against the communist hordes, against China, whatever the case may be. How can we know? The indications are, okay, there's a historic enemy, we have nuclear weapons there, but how can we know that the Bible indicates that it will be Germany actually issuing that attack? The same book in the Bible, Isaiah, gives us the answer. Isaiah 10:5 says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. So before we read that, it was God's answer that he will allow this to punish his nations, and it will lead to the point that cities have to be destroyed because his people, the Israelitish nations, don't heed his warning. They're not repenting from their sin. So God says he will use a specific nation to usher in that punishment, Assyria. Assyria today is modern Germany, and we have our booklet, Germany and the Holy Roman Empire that explains that. But those are just a few details that show everything leads to Germany. And there are other scriptures in Ezekiel that says that it will be the lovers of the Israelitish nations that will betray them. And here again we see that the nations of Israel, United States and Great Britain primarily, are trusting Germany. So this prophecy is another specific prophecy that we are seeing fulfilled.
The prophecy in Ezekiel is extremely dramatic. The language and the poetry, the imagery that it evokes is quite stark and visceral. And Gerald Flory explains that in quite some detail in his booklet, Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet. There's a whole chapter about that betrayal that will come at the hands of the Germans. We'll link to that booklet or that chapter in the show notes for today's program, as well as Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, which you just mentioned. Thank you very much for that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about Germany buying America's stealth jets that can deliver nuclear weapons and other efforts for Germany to increase its nuclear capability after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He's written an article about this that you can find at thetrumpet.com, After Ukraine, Expect Europe to Go Nuclear. A really important story in light of those very dramatic prophecies in the Bible, not only about Germany betraying the nations of modern Israel, including America, but also those prophecies about American cities, the nations of modern Israel, being leveled by nuclear destruction. Thank you very much, Josue.
Thanks for having me again.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, was in Israel last week meeting with leaders in archaeology over there. And some interesting news came out about the Siloam inscription possibly making its way back to Israel. We'll learn about the significance of this archaeological artifact in this report from Chris Eames.
The Siloam Tunnel, otherwise known as Hezekiah's Tunnel, is one of the key archaeological attractions in Jerusalem's City of David. The construction of this tunnel, more than 2,700 years ago, is an engineering marvel, and researchers are still baffled about how it was accomplished. The tunnel snakes some 1,750 feet through the bedrock, bringing water from the Gihon Spring on the northeastern edge of the City of David, straight through the bedrock of the city, down to the southwestern tip of the city, at the Siloam Pool. Impressively, the tunnel was hewn from both ends, the two parties snaking together through the bedrock and meeting up in the middle. And researchers are still befuddled as to exactly how this was accomplished. What's more, the overall gradient on this nearly 2,000-foot-long tunnel is only 0.06 degrees, the exit point merely 12 inches lower than the origin point. Estimates vary as to how long this tunnel took to build, ranging from 9 months to 4 years. The tunnel, in its location and dating, fits together with several biblical verses describing it and the reason for its construction, as part of the preparations for Assyrian King Sennacherib's invasion of Judah during the reign of King Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles 32 verses 2 to 4 read, quote, "And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come, and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" End of quote. The Gihon Spring in the northeastern part of the City of David had already long been solidly fortified. However, archaeologists note that due to the prodigious quantity of water emanating from the spring, there was significant overflow through the city walls, forming streams out into the Kidron Valley. This is the brook that ran through the midst of the land, talked about in 2 Chronicles 32. In the words of King Hezekiah, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water?" In other words, to satisfy their besieging troops. As such, Hezekiah's tunnel was constructed to bring the water down below the city and into a large catchment area at the southwestern end, the Siloam Pool. Verse 30 of 2 Chronicles 32 reads, quote, "This same Hezekiah also stopped the upper watercourse of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works." End of quote. 2 Kings 20 verse 20 likewise reads, quote, "Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might and how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah?" End of quote. In 1880, near the southern end of the tunnel and obscured in darkness for millennia, an inscription was discovered in one of the bedrock walls by a young student who was walking through. The 8th century BC Hebrew inscription is arguably the most important ancient Hebrew inscription of significant length ever discovered. It is a commemorative plaque that describes the mammoth feat of the workmen and how both parties of Judahite tunnelers met in the middle. It is a vividly illustrative document of their efforts, and it reads as follows, quote, "Thus was the tunneling finished, and this was the matter of the tunneling. While the hewers yielded the axe, each man toward his fellow, and while there were still 3 cubits to be hewn, there was heard a man's voice calling to his fellow, for there was a crack in the rock on the right and on the left. And at the end of the tunneling, the hewers hacked each man toward his fellow, axe upon axe, and there flowed the waters from the spring toward the reservoir for 200 and 1,000 cubits, and 100 cubits was the height of the rock above the heads of the hewers." End of quote. And that statement at the end there highlighting just how tall some parts of this tunnel were. But the incredible story of this inscription does not end 2,700 years ago when it was carved, or even when it was rediscovered in the late 1800s with the discovery of the Siloam inscription. Soon after this inscription's rediscovery, the inscription was hewn out of the rock and carted off to Istanbul, in the heart of the Ottoman Empire that controlled Jerusalem at the time. For over 130 years since, the artifact has languished in the Istanbul Museum of Archaeology with certain other significant Jewish artifacts, and for a significant amount of that time, not even on display. But events over the past week indicated that that may have all been about to change.
Well, thank you for that, Chris. So tell us about this latest report about the possibility of the Siloam inscription coming back to Israel.
Sure. Well, it kind of starts last week with our meeting that we had. Many of our listeners will know that Mr. Gerald Fleury came to Israel and had several meetings with archaeology officials, one of which was David Beery. He's the leader of the City of David and the efforts going on down there. And he told us that there were efforts happening as we were speaking to try and get a hold of this Siloam inscription, finally get it repatriated from Turkey. Now, that was last Thursday, and then a couple days later, there was an article from the Times of Israel, scoop article, saying that officials had reached an agreement that that the Siloam inscription would be sent to Israel in exchange for something that Turkey wanted from an Israeli museum. So this was big news. It was broken by the Times of Israel, by an unnamed Israeli official. And so this got a lot of people excited, naturally. But still, the Times of Israel article had said, look, we haven't heard any confirmation from Turkey about this. And so just as of the past day, a new report has come from, I think it was the Jewish agency press or the Jewish press, saying that a Turkish official has come out and said, this isn't happening. It ain't happening. You're not getting the Siloam inscription. So it seems like one of these Israeli officials got ahead of the game, blabbed a little bit too much, made it a little too public. And so now Turkey has come out and said that, no, we're not going to go ahead and make this trade. Which is unfortunate, because this then is another failed attempt, it appears, to retrieve the Siloam inscription. There's been numerous attempts over the past several decades by Israeli officials, by Benjamin Netanyahu. In 1998, he offered that Turkish officials could come to Israel and take anything they want from the museum from the Ottoman period in exchange for this artifact. And then in 2017, there was more of a humorous situation where Israel's culture minister offered elephants for a Turkish zoo in exchange for this inscription. So this inscription really has been on the minds of Israeli officials, repatriating it after nearly 140 years since it was taken from Israel to Turkey.
And why has Turkey refused to give it over?
Well, basically, Turkey's position is that it was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire controlled Jerusalem from 1516 all the way up to 1917. And so it was retrieved during that Ottoman Empire period. Thus, Turkey feels like they have ownership of it. And then besides that, Turkey recognizes the Palestinian territories, as opposed to Israel. And so in their view, according to one Turkish official, he said that it is currently a part of the Palestinian territories. Thus, it is out of the question to return it to Israel, a third country in Turkey's view. So basically, in their mind, it's like legitimizing Israel's right to exist, not only now, but also as it relates to 700 years ago when the inscription was cut.
Well, I don't know if you would know this, but why do you suppose Turkey would seem, for a moment at least, like they were willing to hand it over?
Well, it's a good question. Right now, there's been much talk about warming ties between Turkey and Israel. Actually, this latest delegation that just returned to Israel, they went for a couple of days to Ankara, talked with Erdogan. This has represented the highest level diplomatic meeting Israel has had with Turkey since 2008. So that of itself is pretty significant, especially as we talk about on this program with Bible prophecy, the relationship between Israel and Turkey. And as we know, ultimately, the book of Obadiah, for example, prophesies a betrayal of Israel. And in order for a betrayal to happen, there needs to be some form of a friendship between the two countries. So it seems like there have been warming ties as of especially this past year. And perhaps it's a result of a more left-wing government in Israel at the moment and having more of those overtures that perhaps someone, say, like Benjamin Netanyahu would be less likely to come to. So perhaps that could be a reason.
Well, we will keep our eyes open. I'm sure you can keep us apprised of the developments there. We've been talking with the Trumpet's Jerusalem correspondent, Chris Eames, about Hezekiah's tunnel and the Siloam inscription, important archaeological artifact. He's working on an article on the subject. You can read many of Chris's articles at armstronginstitute.org, the website of the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology, or at watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks so much, Chris. We appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
Lots of people say they believe in a God of love. They recognize his love in God sending his son to pay for the sins of mankind. But then there's the supposedly altogether different God of the Old Testament, a God of plagues and punishments and prophecies. The trumpet focuses on biblical prophecy, so much of which, even though it leads to the only true hope that exists, is dark and painful to think about. Ask yourself, can you recognize the God of love in those prophecies? Biblical prophets were never popular. Their message was despised. Many of them were martyred. Their warnings are still maligned today. Jesus Christ condemned hypocritical religious leaders who said, well, if we'd lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. But these were the very men who were plotting to kill Christ himself. Notice, it's the God of love who sends prophets. Wherefore, behold, Christ said, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify. He prophesied the popular rejection of God's message would continue. But why is prophecy so important to God? Think about this. God's way leads to life, abundant life. Any contrary way leads to misery and death. When people are off course and rebelling, God tries to warn them of the consequences of their actions, as any loving father would. Prophecy is God's way of showing you the end results of the way you live your life, good or bad. For every prophecy about great tribulation, there's another about magnificent blessing. Now, which of them applies to you depends on your choices. Consider the scriptures that speak of the great tribulation. As sure as those prophecies are, so too are others that speak of a small group of people that God will protect from that ordeal. These will be individuals who've already accepted God's correction. They've already turned from the way of death. God doesn't need to inflict the tribulation on them. God never punishes without cause. And then he only does so after he exercises enormous patience. If you respond to God's warning today, you'll be protected. We at the trumpet have to deliver this warning whether or not you respond. The message is as unpopular as it ever was. Like the prophets of old learned through experience, the vast majority of those who hear do not heed. Christ himself, even though he attracted great crowds, he healed countless people, he had a loyal following of only 120 people at the end of his ministry. Even though the trumpet goes to hundreds of thousands of people, there's only a handful who've chosen and committed themselves to God's way of life. But there is a prophecy that gives us tremendous hope as we do this work. It drives us to keep sending out free literature and publishing online and broadcasting on television, even if very few respond today. It's found in Revelation 7, just after the description of the Great Tribulation. It says, after this, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man could number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes. These are they which came out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So the world will have endured the horrifying time of Satan's greatest wrath, but a multitude that is so great it cannot be numbered will come out of the tribulation. They will have accepted God's correction and repented and been spiritually washed by Christ's shed blood. That's a sobering picture, but it is fantastic and inspiring. These people undoubtedly will be people who are familiar with God's warnings, people like you, who study them in the Bible, who read literature from God's work. They'll watch in terror the tragic and nightmarish fulfillment step by step of everything that they'd read about and heard about. And sadly, it'll take being plunged into that shocking reality before they finally realize how deadly serious God was in issuing his warnings. Still, these people will finally recognize the God of love in those prophecies, and they'll turn to him in heartfelt repentance. When they do, God will mercifully protect them from any further punishment, and they'll live to see the dawn of the kingdom of God and its rule on earth. So much of the fruit of God's work today will not be born until that future time. If you listen to the trumpet radio, if you read the trumpet for very long, you get quite a complete picture of the future of world events. Now, if you don't do anything about it, if you don't heed that warning contained in the prophecies that we highlight all the time, then you are described in Ezekiel 33, verses 30 to 32. There God tells his prophet, "And lo, you are unto them as a very lovely song of one that has a pleasant voice and can play well on an instrument, for they hear your words, but they do them not." What choice will you make? If you heed the warning of God's representative today, you can be protected. But if you choose to ignore it, all we ask is that you do not forget it. Remember, as you watch it come to pass before your eyes, remember what God says of you and all who heard his message and knew in advance what would happen. He says there in verse 33, "When this comes to pass, lo, it will come, then shall they know that a prophet has been among them." Remember, so you can recognize the God of love in that terrifying punishment and then act on this precious message of love. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques, Josue Michels, and Chris Eames. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Benjamin Disraeli: to be conscious that you are ignorant of the facts is a great step to knowledge. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.